Going to start our session today. It's got 3:30 just on my smartphone here, just or a couple of seconds before. So this is the panel, Science Literacy, Why 1-2-3 Can Be As Easy As ABC. And speaking as a scientist where numbers came a lot easier than words, I would say it absolutely is as easy as 1-2-3 as easy as ABC. I'm going to start by introducing the panel. Before I do that, I just want a little bit of a sort of a point of procedure about how we do this year at CWA. There's the CWA app that I hope all of you have had a chance to download. And as the moderator, your questions are sent to me on my device. So that's probably the easiest way to get your questions to me. So we'll start with introductory remarks from each of our panelists, and then after that I'll open it up to discussion. And there are two ways you can submit questions. The app is one that'll be right in my hand. If you'd rather, you can also actually write your question on a note card. And our two producers are on either side of the room there. They're holding up their note cards. So if you have a question at any time, you know, even during the opening remarks, if you think of a question you'd really like to ask, just raise your hand, and one of these people will give you a note card. So either use the app or do the note cards. And if you are a student, please note that in your question. We will try to get to student questions as much as we possibly can. We'll sort of prioritize those. Okay, introducing our wonderful panel here. I'll just sort of briefly start with myself. So I'm Dr. Michelle Thaler. I am an astrophysicist. I'm the Deputy Director of Science Communication at NASA. I've worked at, after I did a postdoc at Caltech, I worked at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and also at Goddard Space Flight Center. And I became very interested in how to do science education well. I mean, as a scientist, it seemed to me that we were failing in getting our message out. And I actually give an agency-wide training at NASA for science communication for scientists and engineers. We have commissioned massive research on science literacy in the United States, how something like NASA can help, you know, what is working, what is not. There are not a lot of clear answers coming in, of course, as with most honest research. So this is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. And we have some amazing panelists. So what I'll do is I'm just going to go down and briefly introduce all of the panelists, and then when they begin their opening remarks, they're welcome to add a little more to the introduction if you like. So I'll start with Ellen, and I'll work my way down to Sydney. Ellen here is the president and co-founder of GenSpace, which is really cool. It's a nonprofit laboratory dedicated to getting people involved, public involvement in biotechnology. And in 2011, she initiated GenSpace's award-winning curriculum of informal science education for adults. And in 2014, GenSpace was named as one of the top 10 innovative companies by Fast Company magazine. So GenSpace has been featured in media outlets such as Discover Magazine, Science, Wired, The Economist magazine, as well as on the Discovery Channel, the New York Times, PBS, and the BBC, among many others. Ellen has spent over 30 years in the biotech industry and is now an adjunct professor at the School of Visual Arts at Cooper Union University. So she has some experience working with sort of a non-traditional science education aspect as well. She has two TED Talks. I always encourage you to go look at those if our panelists have those afterwards. One is called Biohacking, How You Can Do It Too. And this is one I'm definitely going to have to look up. And another one is What You Need to Know About CRISPR, which I actually don't know anything about, at the TED Summit in 2016. Her two TED Talks have earned more than 2 million views, so they're very popular talks. After that, we have somebody that I've met before. I had the pleasure of meeting. Eric Lindstrom is also a person from NASA. And he is the lead of a climate focus area at NASA headquarters at the Science Mission Directorate. So that's a tremendously influential, and I'm sure he has a lot to say about how you communicate climate change to the public. He has degrees in Earth and Planetary Sciences from MIT and Physical Oceanography from the University of Washington, a doctorate. His lifelong interest in the ocean has led to ongoing work with the National Geographic Society and also as a scientific consultant on ocean atlases, which sounds totally cool. He spent a lot of time in the field and also with remote sensing. He's been awarded for leadership and service to the ocean community by the American Geophysical Union. And this was pretty amazing. He's the recipient of 4 NASA Exceptional Service Medals. So that's given to only the very height of the leadership, the science leadership at NASA. Okay, after that, we have Dr. Catherine Medler, and she is a professor at the Department of Biological Sciences at the State University of New York, Buffalo. And she's doing some fascinating research. She specializes in the understanding of sensory systems. And she published the first study demonstrating that diet-induced obesity, you know, what you eat and how it makes you obese, has a direct effect on the properties of taste receptor cells. you sort of lose your ability in some ways to actually taste sweetness, depending on this obesity-inducing diet. She has degrees from Texas A&M, San Diego State, and a doctorate from Louisiana State University. And she's also a very active teacher right now. I think she can talk a bit about reaching out to some of the students that she's teaching. And then, at the very end here, we've got Sidney Perkowitz. Sidney is a professor emeritus of physics at Emory University, and he's a freelance writer. And he has written over 100 scientific articles and books, which is just an amazing amount of output. Some of them are The Empire of Light and Hollywood Chemistry. These are sort of popular science books meant for non-scientists. He also has been involved in the theater. His theatrical works have been produced in cities such as New York, Chicago, and Atlanta, and he has appeared in high-profile media outlets such as CNN, NPR, and BBC, and at venues involving NASA and also the Smithsonian Institution. He's a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and has received their Lifetime Achievement Award for Literature, Science, and the Arts. And I think maybe he and Ellen can talk a bit about, because he'll be publishing a book in 2018. It'll be the 200th anniversary of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. So the book will be called Frankenstein 2018, and if we're talking about biohacking and biotechnology, okay, that might be a fun thing to do. So I've asked Ellen to we may have some interesting comments between the panelists too. So I've asked Ellen to start us out. Each speaker will give between 5-10 minute introduction, and then we'll go to questions. Thank you.
So I'll expand a little.
And you work with chickens, I know that.
No, it's just a joke from the last panel. My science communication ability, I was never able to really communicate to my mother what I did. And when I worked on my thesis, it was a chicken virus that was a model for a human virus. But all my mother could grasp out of that was that I worked with chickens, something to do with chickens. And she would send me every article on chickens and tell her friends I worked on chickens who would give me, you know, chicken dishcloths and chicken. So my house is full of chickens. I fell into science communication in a rather weird way. I had a really kind of mediocre career path where I went into the biotech industry. And my last job before GenSpace was directing a group that was looking for biomarkers of tobacco-related harm. And I became aware in 2008 of something called the DIY bio movement, which was a movement to democratize biotech and actually get more people involved in it hands-on as a hobby, because we had reached the point where a lot of the technology was fairly accessible. AP biology classes were now including a bacterial transformation where you actually take a gene from a jellyfish and you put it into E. coli and it turns green, kind of the hello world experiment of genetic engineering. And the time was ripe. The maker movement was, there were maker spaces in all major cities where people work on electronics and computer programming. Why not biology? And I can go, if you're interested, I can talk to you later about the factors that, sort of the perfect storm that came together to make that happen. So I thought it was really great. In 2008, we were coming off 8 years of a president that didn't believe in either global warming or evolution. and science funding was in the toilet. And I was concerned that people didn't value science the way they did when I was a kid, that science was not cool, and that anything that could be done to promote it, including supporting people who wanted to do it as a hobby, was something that I wanted to do. So I ended up co-founding a group in New York City, which eventually became GenSpace, the world's first biohacker space, or community biolab, as we like to call it, because of all the Frankenstein stories. And I've been on this journey now for almost 9 years of trying to communicate science to the general public through actual hands-on involvement in it. And that's the one thing that set GenSpace apart from other kind of science outreach type programming, is we're not an online class. We're not something that's intellectual. We're something that you come in and we actually teach you how to do stuff. And my feeling was that that does more to kind of demystify the technology. Nobody likes to feel like there's some technology that's being imposed upon them. I know I feel this way about computer science because the last programming I did was in the 1970s in Fortran. So when people say they have algorithms that are going to like find out everything about my life or tell me how you know my finances are going to turn out, it's a total black box to me. And there's that feeling of helplessness that someone is imposing this technology on you. And I think in biotech it's particularly scary because you have the feeling it has that potential to affect not only your finances or something that's outside of you, but actually your body. So I gradually made it my mission to try and communicate this to the general public. And I'm not going to talk too long because I don't want to take up too much more than 5 minutes, but one of the things I think we need to think about in this panel is what is science literacy? A lot of scientists seem to think it's that the general public understands what I'm doing well enough to say, yes, go fund it. And if they only understood what I was doing, if I could only explain to them how incredible my experiment is, they would agree with me. And if they don't agree with what I'm doing, it's because they're ignorant and I have to enlighten them. And that's absolutely the wrong way to go about engaging the public with science. So what is literacy? What is science literacy? I think it's the whole shebang all the way up from allowing kids to be curious when they're young and encourage curiosity about the natural world around them to formal and informal science education. It kills me that the public schools in New York are only graded on math and reading, and that a lot of times when we offer them free science programming, it gets pushed out because they don't want their teachers to be distracted by that and put more emphasis on that than something that might affect their funding. So all the way up through adults who didn't choose science as a career, but I'll leave you with this. I always say that I'd like people, my mission is to make sure that people understand enough about DNA and how it works in genetic engineering as they do about electricity. I mean, I don't know all that much about electricity except what I learned in school a long time ago, but I know how to use it. I know how to plug something in. I know that something isn't going to jump out of the light socket and get me the way people thought when electricity was first introduced. And just to have that general working knowledge and that confidence in the technology. And if I can do a small part in making that happen, then I'll feel I've done something worthwhile.
If I could just comment briefly, the idea that just math and reading is what teachers are graded on. I mean, this is something at NASA we really grapple with because we try to sneak in a little science as reading activities or math activities. There's no formal science in the classroom at the moment. Eric.
Okay, thanks very much. So I'm an oceanographer, a program scientist, a funder of science. So I spend a large part of my life with scientists. I kind of consider them all communicators. It's a part of being a scientist, writing papers, sharing with scientists. It's the sharing only with scientists part that seems to bedevil the community because they talk to themselves, but not to so much to the general public, and their depth of knowledge gets farther and farther away from the everyman. So for me, ocean literacy is the problem that I've faced my whole career. I feel like our public understanding of the oceans and the science of the oceans, the impact of the oceans, all these it remains poor. 20 years ago when I joined NASA, I thought, wow, do I have the perfect platform to solve this problem? NASA's the communications juggernaut. And I come to you 20 years later frustrated. So what I've learned is that solutions to some problems get easier as you get older and wiser. But the problem of science and ocean literacy is one that, for me, where the solutions seem to recede as I reach old age and more wisdom. And that's really disconcerting. when I was younger and idealistic, I thought maybe that just communicating to the public really good ideas about what to know at different ages would lead to the uptake. And one finds out very soon that this is not a very successful strategy, that as an individual, you don't make much impact. I went and worked with JPL on some things, and they said, wow, we got this new poster out, and it's in 20 elementary schools. And I was so depressed, because there are more than 80,000 elementary schools in the United States. You know, your ideas have to be scalable, and individuals are not scalable, right? So this brings me to sort of the middle age problem, which is, you know, the evolution of this to that you know you have to do something more. And as I looked into it, curriculum, that's the idea. You know, if you could just get in the curriculum with your science or ocean ideas, that they would be taken up, and that would really make the ideas propagate through all the schools. Well, curriculum is even more resistant to change and very difficult to break. We developed ocean literacy standards, what nationally, what every age group should know. If you're a kindergartner, what should you know about the ocean? Or, you know, you're a fourth grader, what should you know about the ocean? You try and push that around the country, and you just don't break in to pass this reading and math barrier. So the senior me wants to know how to correct the curriculum problem. So one idea is you need to get into the textbooks. And so if you can create little earth science stuff and ocean stuff for textbooks. But then getting into textbooks is not a science or educator problem. It's a business problem. You have to crack the Texas or California market, and then others will follow. So it's a big business problem of how to get in a textbook. So I'm very frustrated, and I kind of hope that we can talk about some of these ideas, and you can get me juiced up for one more run at this.
So, you know, I'm a professor in the biology department. I don't have expertise like these people do of actually communicating science to the general public. I certainly teach to students, to graduate students and undergraduate students, and there's certainly the big push in college stuff now is like, oh, you don't give them facts, just give them, teach them how to critically think, because they can't critically think. And they can't critically think because they haven't learned how to do that all the way up. But they also kind of need to know what facts they need to know, so then they can start putting it together. So it's kind of a frustrating situation. I don't have a lot of insight except that my kids are in the New York schools and they have science testing, so I'm not sure what you guys are talking, you know, what are you, like, New York City?
It's what the funding is based on. It's standards for funding. I mean, yeah. I mean, they have things like AP biology, but...
Well, and they have state testing for science at certain years that they have to take.
I mean, I don't know. This is just what I've been told by the teachers.
Okay, yeah. No, I mean, they get, actually, my kids' personal children get a lot of science, but, I mean, we're in a good school district. But yeah, I think, I don't know. I don't have a lot of other than my mother also has a hard time understanding what a cell is. I mean, thankfully I work on the taste system, so she understands what that is. But yeah, there's not a lot of understanding. And so I think that it's important for, I think the general public has a hard time understanding, you know, because you'll see these senators will come up and they'll go, why are we studying ant colonies? Or why are we studying bears and stuff like that? Why are we funding these things? And I think the science community needs to do a better job of trying to explain to you, to the general public and to senators, why those kinds of things are really important, because we can't predict what the next thing is going to be. So Alan was mentioning the jellyfish G protein, GFP protein, and that protein has actually revolutionized science because it's a small protein and it's fluorescent, and people have figured out a way to tag it to promoters of all different kinds of genes. So we can use transgenic mice, we can have them express GFP in a certain population of cells or cells that express a certain protein. So you can open up a brain and you can see where the cells that express that protein are. And it's like there's no way that we could have ever done that before. And so you said, why would I study a jellyfish? Why should I care about a jellyfish? I don't know, right? But somebody, they're really smart people and they figured it out. They had this information about this protein that's fluorescent and they were able to apply it in a completely different way. Another great example of, as I was reviewing a grant of people trying to study how caterpillars walk across, in general, just walk. And again, you could go, why do I care about why a caterpillar walks? And it's like, well, maybe you don't, but actually these people had figured out that, you know, caterpillars don't have bones. They have this exoskeleton that they can move around, and they're really good about moving and crawling up a bumpy leaf or over mud or whatever. They're really good at moving themselves around. But robots actually are not. And so a robot's really great about walking out as long as he's on a flat cement surface. But if he's out in a minefield trying to get, you know, pick up mines or something, and you're putting a robot out there instead of a person, he's going to hit a rock or a stick or something, and he's going to get stuck. And he's not going to be able to move anymore. And so understanding how caterpillars can move themselves over these complicated surfaces without muscles and bones can actually translate into something that's a very practical, everyday type of thing. And it's like, I think that lots of times people get scared of science or they think it's a waste of money. Why should I care? You know, my cousin, the insurance agent, why am I funding? Why are my tax dollars paying for you? And it's because he has no context of understanding. It's like science has improves and continues to improve our lives and every day and every way. You know, that we can do things, you know, a lot of us are, you know, we're here and we're relatively healthy, and that's because medicine has just figured out so many things over the last 50 or 100 years. And it's just, but it's a slow process and it's a very broad process, and I think it needs to be communicated in general better to the general public so we can, because yeah, I can't tell you why ant colonies are really important, but people that actually study systems and think about how they can make drones coordinated and do things, they can tell you why it's important to understand how colonies work together. And so it's sometimes you have that little bit of information and people take it and apply it in completely different ways. So it's important. Anyway.
Thank you, Sydney.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for sticking around so late. It's always a good sign. We'll try to keep you awake. I'll do my best anyway. This was a great title for this panel. At first, I didn't know what it meant, and then I thought of more things to talk about than I can fit into 10 minutes. So I'm going to cover just three things. One, the title, 1, 2, 3, Can It Be As Easy As ABC? Well, that implies that we have a problem with people who are enumerate, which is the equivalent of being illiterate. So I'll talk a little bit about that. Two, the title also implies that reading is easier than math, and I'm going to say something about that. And then I'll talk a little bit generally about science communication and science literacy. Enumeracy, I think everyone knows that the U.S. doesn't do very well in math education. I want to give you an example that may not be obvious to you where this is important. If you've ever followed any kind of medical news, and you look in the paper and you read on Tuesday, chocolate is good for you, and next Friday it says, oh no, a new study shows that chocolate is bad for you. That is an example of mathematical enumeracy, because most medical research is done is based on statistical results. They feed something, chocolate or a drug, to a group of people, do a statistical analysis, come up with a conclusion. I've taught pre-meds for many, many years. Pre-med students do not know math. The science journalists who report medical results do not know math, and the American public does not know math. But now that you know that this is based on statistics, and the people doing the statistics are not very good at it, you can understand why the medical results go from black to white, yes to no, over the span of 2 weeks. Because that's one example of being enumerate that really affects our society. Next question is, can math be as easy as ABC? In other words, put it in more general terms, is it harder to be good at math than it is to be a good reader? And there's actually data about this. I checked this out. There's a group called PISA. It's the Program on International Student Assessment. They check out students aged 15 in about 50 different countries in science, math, and reading, highest to lowest. What country, if you can count it as a full country, does the best in all three of those categories? Singapore. No surprise. How does the U.S. stack up? Well, in science, we are 60 points behind Singapore on a scale of 1,000. In math, we're 100 points behind Singapore on a scale of 1,000. And in reading, we're only 40 points behind Singapore on a scale of 1,000. So if you take those numbers seriously, the U.S. does poorly in all of them, but we do less poorly in reading. So putting the best positive spin on that I can, it means, yes, in the U.S., we're doing a slightly less worse job of teaching reading than we are teaching math. Doesn't give us much room for hope, but it does say if we could teach people to read, maybe we can teach them to do math better, too. Okay, third area, science literacy in general. Now, what's my background on this? I'm not a professional on this either, as some of the people on this panel are, but I do write popular science for people, and I have also taught a lot of, not only pre-meds, but a lot of science students. And I think I've come up with two or three conclusions. One is, for those who are going to be scientists, or just love the idea of science, the important thing is not so much to feed them facts, is to get the passion going. And if you're going to be a real scientist, you need to get the passion going, because doing science is hard. There is no way to make the actual science simpler for a working scientist. You have to get them committed to doing it. And one of the ways to get them committed is to give them hands-on experience. Ellen is a professional at that. My university, Emory, has a goal of every science major or every student who takes at least one science course, and all our students do, have at least one research experience, and that's a key thing. Second point, excuse me, my throat is going. If you're trying to reach people who are not going to be scientists, then the key thing is to tie the science to something they know about or put it in a context that makes sense to them. So here's one example. This is a book written by a friend of mine. It's called, it's a takeoff on a pun. You've probably all heard of fuzzy logic, which is a kind of artificial intelligence thinking which deals with ideas that are kind of nebulous, vague ideas. This book is called Furry Logic, and the subtitle is The Physics of Animal Life. Now, what a brilliant idea. Who wouldn't like to figure out how their favorite cat or dog knows more physics than we do in the way that they function out in the world? In my own experience, these are the kinds of contexts I brought in. I've taught courses in science and art, science and film, which is really a winner, because most kids, I shouldn't say most, but many kids, many would-be scientists, get science through film, science fiction film, but it's still science, and finally science journalism. And once you put those things in context, you're reaching students who maybe aren't even going to ever be science majors, but at least they learn a little science. They walk out of a course knowing how DNA works or why nuclear power has pluses and minuses. You've really done a lot. And one other thing in those courses, which I've done especially in my art and journalism courses, and people don't mention this enough, I think it's important. In those two courses, science and art, science and journalism, I made the students go out and meet artists and meet scientists. And this is really important. It's usually said, the reason usually given is they need to see a role model for what a scientist or an artist does, but there's a more important reason. In our society, they need to see a role model for someone who is driven by a goal in life that is other than a corporate existence and other than only making money. They're driven by some kind of passion. I think that's really important. And it won't catch every child or every person that you try to reach out, but it'll catch a lot of them, and that's a key thing in science communication. That's it. I've covered everything I wanted to say. Thank you.
I guess we'll start taking questions both with the app and with cards. But I think Ellen started us out on a really interesting question. I think we're talking about something that hasn't really been defined yet. What do we mean by science literacy? And I think one of the things that is a misconception about science literacy, although it's something that I also love, is that an educated person might have a certain number of facts at their disposal. They might know certain things about the ocean, or they might know certain things about the solar system. There's also the idea that science literacy is the ability to use critical thinking. That, you know, I mean, I cannot tell you how many times in the last couple of months I've gotten emails from people that think the Earth is flat. That did not used to happen. As somebody that does NASA outreach. And part of that, I think, is sort of the prevalence of these you know, fake news sites and the inability of people often to distinguish between where information comes from There's a wonderful democratization of knowledge that the internet has fostered, and there are good things about that. But one of the things that's a challenge is people not being able to balance whether they hear this on a NASA site or on a site that has basically no scientific affiliation at all. If I could ask the panelists to maybe comment on this about you know, perhaps what you would define as science literacy and maybe what could be done to address these critical thinking areas as well.
So I'd jump in. I was thinking that I guess I've reached a point where I don't think literacy is about teaching at all. It's not about reading, math, or these fact-based things, although we spend a lot of time trying to do it that way. It's really more about fostering a lifelong curiosity so that people can take up information. And what we don't have is ready minds. And so we have to kind of get our kids thinking curiosity ways. And I felt like my education turned around when I went to MIT. And they said, well, you won't have any tests that aren't open book. And it was more about how do you solve problems, not that you had to know the formula or know the facts. You can always look that stuff up, but you had to figure, they were going to teach you over 4 years how to solve problems. And that's the sort of curiosity building that I think we need to do more of.
The last panel I was on, somebody said, okay, you know, what's a three-year-old's favorite word?
Why?
Why? Why? Why? And after a while, adults say, because. And that's sort of the beginning of the end of, you know, curiosity. Because if you cut it off, I mean, obviously there are practical reasons where you can't answer it forever. But I would say not only the curiosity, but as Michelle was pointing out, the ability to vet your sources. So you mangled my academic affiliations a little. There's the School of Visual Art in New York, and also the Cooper Union, which is an arts and engineering school with a venerable reputation. It used to be completely free but highly selective, and now they've gone through some financial times, and they're actually whores charging some nominal tuition. But I teach in the art department in both, and one of the classes I'm teaching this semester is about food, and I'm trying to get people to look at what's on websites, particularly stuff about GMOs. And it's frightening, but terribly human, because we're all bombarded with so much information that probably very few people click through the first thing on a website. And like there was a site that was saying that GMOs caused liver cancer in rats. And it reported it as if it was a news article. And then it had a click-through link. And when you went to the link, the article didn't say anything like that. And you just have to wonder how many people actually clicked through this link and how many people, and news services, just picked it up and ran with it because they found it on this website. So it's great that we don't have to carry those facts around in our head, although a little frightening when you're teaching, right? And somebody starts pulling out their iPhones and checking whatever it was you just said. But you know, it we live in a different age now. And also, the other thing is, when you say literacy, there's so much more to know. When I was in high school, I was making macaroni models of cells, you know. And now the kids that come into me are doing sophisticated calculations of DNA structure in the better high schools.
Right.
And so there's so much to know. And I guess the advanced placement biology test just went through this huge soul searching because they realized it was impossible to drill all the facts in that they were doing before. And now they're trying to be more problem solving. That's like the big catchphrase now in education, is this inquiry-based learning.
Right.
That's a good sign, but I'm still not sure that that's going to solve the problem.
Can I jump in about checking sources? So 10 years ago, I would have said the most important thing for someone reading a newspaper article or going on the internet, an article about some scientific finding, who said it? Who's the author of the article? And after a while, people learn, well, if it came to the National Academy of Sciences, it doesn't guarantee it's right, but it means people thought about it seriously. If it came from the Flat Earth Society, maybe there's an agenda that you need to know about. But now our sources have become so tainted, Ellen referred to this, that you can't tell a student or even yourself sometimes what source is real and what isn't. I think we've entered a new era, and this is really terrible, terrible news. To me, science literacy is not so much giving them a bunch of facts or a particular theory, it's telling them where to go to get an opinion that is a thoughtful opinion about it. No one who isn't a professional geneticist or what have you will form his or her own opinion about whether a certain genetic procedure works or not. In the last analysis, you'll end up listening to some authority. Well, who's the real authority anymore? That's really the question.
And the eroding of trust in government also doesn't help, because
right.
Actually, in a gathering of scientists that were talking about science advocacy and you know, marching on Washington that we're going to do on Saturday and stuff, one woman was frustrated because she said, you know, I was talking to this person, and they were saying that unemployment under Obama was terrible and now it's great. And she was saying, well, no, actually, unemployment went down every year. And the person was like, well, where did you get those figures? And she said, well, the Department of Labor. And the person said, well, you know, I don't trust those. Mm-hmm. And then she stopped and she said, and this is my dad. And I couldn't convince him. So it is really frightening when you get to this post-fact society. Trying to drill down to those sources and what we take for granted people will trust, maybe they don't now.
You had something to say, too.
Yeah, did you want to say something?
Oh, no,
okay.
That's all right.
I remember the late Carl Sagan, who was certainly an inspiration to me, taught. He ended up just basically teaching a single course at Cornell University, and that was basically bullshit detection. You know, I mean, how you can look at any sort of, you know, theory and actually figure out whether it works or not, a big part of science literacy. All right, as promised, I'm going to the questions from the audience, and there is one from a student. He or she starts with, I'm a student, thank you very much. The question is, what ways of spreading science literacy are best in formal education environments, like schools, and what are best for informal environments, such as museums? So the formal versus informal, different techniques, different strategies for science literacy? Anybody care to address that?
Well, just one comment. One government organization and maybe we can't trust it anymore. I hope we can. National Science Foundation used to put a lot of money into informal science education. They broke out of that rigid structure and thought of forums like this, citizens' meetings, hands-on labs, like Ellen runs, as putting money into to get people turned on. That money has been turned off. So I think informal science education is a great direction to go, and we're doing some of it right here, or maybe not exactly this panel, but many other panels. But it no longer is even getting much government support. This is quite prior to the present administration. It goes back quite a few years. To me, it's one of the best ways to teach science. And it ties in with another point I'd like to make. If you're someone who's trying to communicate science and you have 20 minutes or an hour, whatever length of time, don't try to fill that time with all the science you know in the world. If people walk away with two facts after half an hour, you've done very well. I was on a panel about exploring the solar system, and two people on the panel, I was one of them, mentioned the same point. The amount of time it would take NASA with present technology to reach the nearest star that we think has nice planets, which is Proxima Centauri, would be 80,000 years. If you have that number in your head, you get some sense of how big the universe is and how hard it will be to explore the whole thing. I think that's really conveying a basic science idea, just one idea and a very good one to take away.
So I do want, so for the National yeah. Science Foundation, so it actually does still have...
Still does, good.
They do support, you know, community things, but actually every single person who gets funding from National Science
that's
Foundation
right.
has to have some aspect right. of their research that's called broader impacts that's either helping to bring underrepresented minorities or women up into doing scientific things or having outreach or some sort of educational aspect to it. So that is a big part of their
yeah,
mission
you're right.
that they still do. But, of course, their budget is very, very small, and the current president didn't even mention them in his budget, so I don't know if that meant he's closing them down or what exactly, but, you know, they actually do a lot of you know, non-health-related research and things, you know, any kind of, anything that doesn't have to do with saving human lives, then that's the kind of scientific research that they do.
Yeah, NSF is charged with funding what would be called basic research, mm-hmm. so the caterpillars, things that you wouldn't ordinarily think are directly applicable. NIH is more biomedical research. However, I'm going to push back a little on that, because even though NSF has that requirement, most people just do a checkbox on it. They give a few lectures, they do this, and they say, okay, that box is checked. The other thing is you don't want to dedicate a lot of the funding in your grant to that. So usually that part of the grant, because we tried to partner with people, mm-hmm. and we did an analysis, and we realized it wasn't a way that our organization could get paid to do anything.
I think there's a lot of scientific training that goes on with NSF, mm-hmm. and that, you know, that they will encourage you to maybe reach out to C-STEP programs or other types of programs for to try to tap into student populations that don't normally think about going into STEM mm-hmm. work. So
well, that's good.
And some of it just depends on how accessible your research is, right? In terms of being able, there's, I mean, I have reviewed a lot of grants for NSF, and some people are very good at, and you know, they have things that they can do. People that work on, just one guy I'm thinking of, like, works on C. elegans, which is a great model system to figure out a lot of genetics and stuff. And he actually has, but they require a lot of care. And he actually partners with Down syndrome people in his community, and the halves of people with special needs come in and actually help take care of the worms and stuff. And so they learn how to do some of these basic kinds of stuff. And so some people have a great passion to really do some sort of those kinds of
stuff. Sure, I mean, it's individual.
But yeah, and so it depends on the work and, you know, kind mm-hmm. of. But certainly that there has to be something, right? So you can have the most fantastic grant in the world, and if you ignore the broader impact, you're not going to get the grant.
Well, just one thing. Just getting back to that question of the difference between teaching and outreach. One thing that you learn really quickly is when you go out to the general public is they're a lot different than teaching students that are required to take a class in school, who will sit there and absorb stuff and be very focused, because if they don't pass the class, they won't get to the next rung of the ladder.
Right.
Whereas the general public is more like entertainment. I even call them the Discovery Channel crowd when they come into GenSpace. You'll see them on their cell phones going, yeah, I'm doing genetic engineering this afternoon to their friends.
Yeah.
So it's a different approach, and I think Michelle on a different panel described it as really trying to inspire that sense of connection and wonder with science to a certain extent, and also making it personal when you can. Like, we run classes where you can analyze food to see whether or not it is what it says on the label. So truth in food labeling. There was a team of high school students that analyzed the sushi in their local restaurants and found that 30% of the fish was mislabeled. And so stuff like that, you know, bring in your goat cheese will tell you whether they're cutting it with cow's milk. When there was that big horse meat scandal in Europe, people went to the DIY labs in Europe and brought in their hamburger samples to see if they could pick up any signs of horse meat in the meat. So making it personal.
I would put in a provocative idea on this formal versus informal education. I sometimes feel like there's a war on informal education by the formal education bureaucracy. There are the education bureaucracy has its ways and means that you're supposed to educate people, and one of the most successful, I think, endeavors we in the federal agencies have taken on in the ocean realm was the National Ocean Science Bowl, which has been going on for 20 years for high school teams to compete on ocean knowledge. And now, 20 years on, we have a lot of ocean scientists who came out of that. But we had a tough time funding it because the professional education bureaucracy says that using buzz-in things, quick responses to questions, is not appropriate. And that there should be no money going into anything that you have to buzzer in on. And it's baffling to me that it, well, the people love it, the students love it, it works, but the bureaucracy will shut down and say, well, you can't be funding that. So, you know, here at NASA, I've still been funding it. It's hidden in the research program. We're not allowed to do this.
Like money.
Yeah. So, yeah, I can get you 100 reviews that say it's a wonderful thing, except the one from the Department of Education who would say that I am barking up the wrong tree.
To give you a little bit of an example, you know, NASA used to fund programs to train teachers, to have teacher workshops at things like the National Science Teachers Association. The Department of Education said there's no research to support that that's a worthwhile thing to do, to train teachers in NASA materials. And so all of our programs were canceled to train teachers. This gives you a sense a little bit of some of the environment that we work in. It's not a simple thing for a scientist to get something into an approved state or national curriculum. It's not even simple to get approval from the government to work with teachers. You know, it's an interestingly complex thing to be here as scientists saying, how do we affect scientific literacy? I noticed that, you know, one of the things we don't have on the panel is an actual professional educational strategist, right? Somebody that actually knows how to get things into curriculum, that sort of thing. So, I mean, it is a very, very complex environment to do this. Is it all right if I go on to another question? Is everybody okay?
Yeah, sure.
This is one as well that's kind of near and dear to my heart. One of the ideas in working with scientists that I do, to teach them to communicate, is the idea of dumbing down what they do, or dumbing down science. And part of this, in my view, does actually go into the category, is your goal to actually communicate? Or is your goal to show somebody how smart you are and how much information and how many PowerPoint slides you can produce in an hour? You know, or was your goal, as Sydney was saying, to have them maybe walk away with one or two points? And that is very difficult for scientists. So the person actually mentions this. So the question is, how do you find a way to explain science to the general public in an understandable way without dumbing down and sensationalizing it to the extent that the underlying facts change? And the example they give is, for example, climate change. You know, how do we communicate climate change? It's a complex thing. Do you dumb it down? Do you get sensationalistic responses from the panel on that?
Well, yeah, so I'm being the climate focus area lead at NASA headquarters. I have this target on my back, so I always worry about what I'm going to say about climate. But I feel like the most successful strategies are not, they're sort of dumbing down from the scientist perspective, but it's about giving the public a couple of facts that are really critical in framing their thought about the issue. I heard a good one in another panel this morning from Carrie Emanuel was talking about going back to the 19th century and Gustav Arrhenius's work on gases in the atmosphere and showing he made a back of the envelope calculation on how much a doubling of CO2 would make in warming the Earth, and it was 4°C. He's still within the error bars, right? Didn't take a computer model. It didn't take. It just took some lab experiments, some calculations, some thought, and so we haven't disproven it. It's all we've done is added on to this idea. It's the core of the idea about global warming. It's a simple one, and if you can just transmit this little bit of information, maybe the people's curiosity and idea of what is the fact out there can be changed.
I guess I don't really, I think you have to, so people that are doing science, it's all about being very precise, and that's because you get stomped on if you talk sloppy about things or you try to overinterpret something. So we're trained when we're communicating with each other and communicating our data to be very precise about what it means and what it does, and here's this caveat and here's that caveat. And that's fine if you're already in the context of the whole thing, but when I'm teaching to my students who are just getting neurobiology for the first time, I need them to understand the basic facts. So I don't think it's a dumbing down kind of thing, it's just I'm giving them the first layer of stuff. And if I'm talking to the sixth and ninth grade girls about how taste works, because I work on taste, you know, we're taking it down another level because they don't have the frame of reference to understand all of the mechanics and the specifics of how cell signaling and stuff works. So I don't really think it's dumbing down. I think it's really just communicating effectively to your audience. Because I could, yeah, garble off a lot of jargon to you, and it's like, and no one in the room, probably even myself, is going to know what I'm talking about that at some point, right? So I don't, I guess it's like, I think you have to, if you're going to be effective in communicating, you need to communicate to something that people can understand and relate to, which is like very quickly, right? If you're getting off on some of your stuff over here with climate change, it's like, I don't know what you're talking about because I'm a biologist, right? So it's like, so you lose your, whoever your audience is, whether I'm talking to my peers or to my students or to the high school girls or junior high girls, then I have to talk about it in a different way. So I don't think, I don't, certainly don't change facts, but I don't get into, well, it's this, except if it's going to be that, or if we're looking at this and it's that, because then it's like, then nobody listens anymore. They don't care.
I think one of our flaws and strengths as scientists is if we feel we give incomplete information, it's tantamount to lying.
Right.
And so we tend to be like kind of Asperger syndrome people that have to drill that entire explanation into you, or we don't feel we've done our job. And this can be really bad, particularly when you enter the area of something like risk assessment, where, as Sid was saying, people don't really don't understand math. And the analogy I always say is, well, what does the head of Amtrak say when you ask if is riding Amtrak safe? What's he going to say, right? Of course it's safe. He's not going to say, well, it's generally safe, but last year we had 6 accidents and, you know, 7 people were decapitated. And, you know, he isn't going to go through all the minutiae of every single thing that happened that was an anomaly. The system in general is safer than driving a car. And public figures in other disciplines know how to communicate that sort of stuff. But somehow scientists really shy away from any kind of black and white pronouncement. And I ran up against this when people were saying, well, you've got amateurs doing biotechnology. Is it safe? And I learned very quickly to deflect the question and say, well, you know, we've been examined by the biosecurity community and they have no problems with us. And they're the professionals and I defer to their opinion. But it took me a while to get that soundbite in because it is very hard for us to just talk in absolutes. And I think that's one of the issues that we face, is that you have to give an executive summary. It isn't always appropriate to go into too much detail.
Can I make a comment, too, before the next question?
Yeah, of course.
Catherine used a really important point with a really important word. The word was jargon. So one way to train scientists to communicate better is to force them for a while, just as an exercise, to write and talk without jargon. Jargon just kills the whole thing. You know, jargon is what your doctor uses when he wants to give you bad news or doesn't quite understand what's going on. He or she pulls out some Latin words, and then you're stonkered. The ball game's over. And scientists tend to do the same thing. We love acronyms, we love abbreviations, all the rest of that. When I teach science writing, one exercise I have the students do is explain how an airplane flies in a written paragraph. So the first explanation from the science students is full of words that no one understands. I make them rewrite it without those words and half as long. And you know what? You can do it. If you make scientists do that when they're talking about science, you would have had a great step forward.
We not only have trouble with jargon, but one of the things that we train people at NASA do, there are expressions that scientists use. Like we might talk of something as being on the order of something.
Right.
Or
That's
we might say something is within a magnitude. Or another one is somebody recently was giving a public talk, and I was taking notes about their talk, and they talked about, well, we're not sure if it's a discrete solution. And the scientists use the word discrete to mean something that's very well-defined and kind of easily isolatable, as opposed to something that's very polite, you know. And so there's not only a technical jargon, but there's phrases and manners of speech that separate us.
We were talking about the word theory.
Theory,
remember?
Yeah.
The difference between a hypothesis and a theory in our panel about science deniers, and that, you know, people throw the word theory around as if it's a hypothesis, which is something that you haven't really tested yet necessarily. Whereas a theory is something that there's a huge body of data to support if it becomes an actual scientific theory.
This kind of leads into a number of questions that I'm getting that are all kind of along the same theme. I mean, one of them says, in response to Sydney's comments about medical studies switching conclusions, do you think this is also an issue of people not understanding the importance of replicating a study to really accept a conclusion? Other people simply say, you know, let's start with, you know, basically, what is science, right? You know, what is science? What is the process of science? You know, are there ways that we can help the public understand the power and limitations of the scientific process? Any questions about that, or should we go on to another one? Okay. So another one says, how can we further university discourse by implementing interdisciplinary studies? And would this help with science literacy?
It would, but it's the hardest thing on earth to do just because of the way universities are structured. To become a successful university professor, you earn tenure in a department. Department means a specific area. You have to work hard in that area, biochemistry, physics, English, whatever. Until you can earn that tenure, it's very hard to reach out and make a connection with another department, because then you have to be rated by two different groups of people to get tenure, and suddenly the ball game is really not in your favor. It's a very difficult thing to do. So most people who become interdisciplinary, at least in my experience, and this is only academia, outside academia it's easier in some ways, are people who are further along in their careers, which is great for them. They're protected, they have tenure. On the other hand, you want to reach out to young people. You really want young scientists to be able to do this, not only older scientists. That's a structural issue that I've never seen a good solution to. I wonder if anyone in the panel has a different comment about that.
I see it from a different perspective. I'm not in an academic institution, but I get all the academics' proposals for interdisciplinary science, and interdisciplinary science is the hardest thing to get peer-reviewed.
Right, there you go.
So it's hard to fund be successful. So, but I would say, is it off topic, really, for us? I mean, it'd be nice if all the scientists learned to talk to one another, but is that solving the grander science literacy problem? I'm not so sure.
I wonder if the question, when you think about interdisciplinary studies, you know, I think the conclusion we sort of have leapt to is, you know, interdisciplinary science studies, but what about taking it farther than that? You know, I mean, so you are teaching at a visual arts college.
Yeah. It's tough because the metrics are so different. Actually, bio art is a recognized field of art now, and there was an attempt, I think 2 years ago, for the NSF and the NEA to get together and issue grants on the art-science interface. And they had a few meetings, and from what I understand, it just broke down because the metrics for success were so different, and accomplishment and worth were so different that they couldn't reach any kind of an understanding.
There's a huge personal plus, though. I just want to tell you 2 minutes for a personal experience. I was an adjunct professor of humanities at Atlanta College of Art, which is purely for art students, of course. I taught relativity to art students, and if you think that isn't fun, because they came up with the most interesting questions that no scientist in the world would ever think of. They managed to stump me every time. They really stretched my mind in trying to find answers that would satisfy them. So it was a great experience for me. I'm not so sure about them, but at least for me, yes.
Yeah, it's great because, you know, even the general public will come in and they'll ask questions, and it's things that you take for
granted. Right.
You know, and you don't know, you know, they'll say, well, what do you mean this is a low copy number plasmid? Why?
Right.
And it's like, well, because it is.
It's like answering a child. You're back to because, right?
The next class.
You're back to because.
Right.
There's a student out there, a student question that I swear is a plant. I'm going to thank you for this ahead of time. It says, I am a student. Do you think NASA's expansion into citizen science and crowdsourcing research with projects such as the search for exoplanets has affected science literacy in the general public? This is something that I'm actually in charge of at NASA headquarters,
wow,
is our citizen science projects. We currently, in the Science Mission Directorate, fund about 20 projects for anybody with no science training to actually, through the internet and through very, very well-researched user interfaces, help us analyze our data. They have discovered entirely new classes of galaxies that existed only at the beginning of the universe. They've helped us discover hundreds of candidates for stars that have planets around them, and we have discovered dozens of actually of exoplanets, planets around other stars, just using public participation. There's also ways to help with climate change research and the incredible GLOBE program that I think Eric is probably at least a little bit familiar with. The question, though, is one that's very difficult for me. Can you show that it affected science literacy?
Yeah.
How do you measure that?
Yeah.
And as a scientist, and as a scientist who, when you report your money, we're using taxpayer money, did anything happen for the millions of dollars we invested in these programs? Can we show something happened? Is that even a reasonable question to ask? Can you measure it? You know, I do a lot of work in social media. We knew that there were not enough women coming to the NASA social media websites. Interestingly, simple solution was getting on Pinterest. Our numbers of women coming to our websites jumped amazingly, measurably. I could bring the statistics. As amazing as citizen science is, the question gets at this problem. Can you measure something changing, and how would you do that? So I think we have two sort of challenges to the panelists. I mean, you can talk about the use of citizen science and crowdsourcing and whether you think that's a good idea to help with science literacy. And perhaps a follow-on question is, how do we measure science literacy?
Yeah. So I like the second question better. how do we measure it? I mean, I'm an ocean observer, and we're all about measurement, and I feel... what my wisdom, if, you know, after all these decades of, you know, knocking my head against the wall about the literacy problem, is trying to redefine what I think about what literacy is so that it might be measurable. Because I think of it as really about the scalability and penetration of ideas. We have good ideas. Scientists are coming up with good things, good facts, good information, good ways to think about things. But how do we need to transmit them to, you know, 7 billion people, and we need to know, measure, how well they're taking up this stuff or, you know, and advancing things. So I think that if we got away from whether it's galaxies or planets or ocean or whatever, and try to break it down as a more abstract problem, and then think about how you would measure this kind of the scalability in numbers and a penetration through some sort of surveys, that it might be a tractable problem.
I thought you said there were science literacy studies.
Well, we've commissioned science literacy studies. There's a person named Dr. Miller from the University of Michigan who's actually right now being commissioned by the Science Mission Directorate at NASA to produce a science literacy study. The thing that I, as a physical scientist, am nervous about is, you know, are we actually measuring something? And you know, I mean, can I believe that? There's, especially when it comes to working with people like the Department of Education, where they say there's no research to support that working with teachers is any good, and then they cancel your funding. How could you measure it, right? I mean, how could we show that specifically the NASA dollars helped a teacher teach science better?
I mean, there are professional evaluators that question all the time. And some of it, unfortunately, is whether or not, say, a child went on to pursue a science career, or even attitudes like questionnaires about, would you consider becoming a scientist now, things like that. But I agree, sort of the hard numbers are there's also a very interesting test out of the University of Tennessee on critical thinking, which some of my colleagues that are involved in some high school science programs use. And apparently it's very stringent, and it's very involved, and they take great pains to be to have the results be as objective as possible.
We employ external evaluators in every education project we undertake, and it has to be looked at by people that know about educational research. I think science literacy is something that's proved slippery. You know, can you show that you're actually impacting science literacy?
Mm-hmm. I refuse to believe that literacy is a more difficult problem than quantum mechanics.
No. Anything that involves people is more difficult than physics. That's a blanket statement.
There's another question about how to get it, sort of people that interact with the public, and this is something as well. So one person suggests continuing education for newscasters and local news. You know, could these people spend a weekend learning fundamentals about a specific science effort from an actual scientist? Or national news convince news directors that writers and reporters need to develop familiarity with different areas of science? Are there initiatives like this? One thing I'll mention at NASA that's really been very, very useful is our outreach to the meteorologists, the people that do the local weather at many, many hundreds of local stations yeah. across the country. In many cases, we found these people were the only scientists that the public right. could really readily identify. Right. It was their local meteorologist, their weatherman or weatherwoman, or unfortunately, as they would say, weather girl. And a lot of these meteorologists had not really been trained in some of the fundamentals of climate change. And we hired Joe Witte, who was actually a very high-profile meteorologist, I believe, for CBS News. If Joe's going to smack me. It was one of the major news outlets. And Joe went all around the country talking to local meteorologists and meteorological conventions. And I now see far more coverage and acceptance of climate change topics on local news. What do you think about that, about going after the media?
I actually have a comment on that. There is truly an organization called National Association of Science Writers. I belong to it. They have an annual meeting, and one thing they do at every meeting is to take science journalists to local labs. They have lecturers come in, they have lab visits, and they really try to give them an intensive 2 or 3 days of exposure to more science than they already know. So there are some small efforts to do this. I don't know of any effort that's bigger than that, however. And the point about meteorologists is great, too. The average American has seen only one scientist, and that's a meteorologist. And by the way, that meteorologist probably went to Penn State. That turns out more meteorologists than any other university. If you ever meet a meteorologist, tell him or her, I know where you went to school, Penn State, and you'll be 90% right.
I have sort of one small personal experience. I lived in Australia in the 1980s. I worked for the Australian government in oceanography. In our marine lab, we had the same problem of outreach and the public in Tasmania understanding what we did. And the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization that I worked for was having this problem all over the country. And their solution was to have artists in residence at each of the laboratories and brought in an artist. And we had much, much more public through the lab and exposure by having an artist in the lab for a year talking to us, the scientists, translating these ideas into abstract forms and beautiful sculpture, paintings, whatever. They decorated the lab, brought people in, started a conversation. So maybe the path is a little less direct than we want it to be.
I have a comment on that. Our experience at GenSpace was artists kind of found us first because bioart was a big thing. And it really depends on the artist. A lot of artists get very offended that they are just going to be some sort of mouthpiece for science. They want to be included as a full collaborator in some way. Sometimes that's possible, sometimes that's really difficult. Certainly data visualization, there's a lot of stuff that can be done collaboratively. But one of the things that happened at GenSpace was, at first it was great, you know, the artistic projects, particularly one where this woman went around collecting chewing gum off the streets of New York City, extracting DNA from it, and using markers, what we know about markers of appearance in DNA. So she had the DNA analyzed, and she was printing 3D portraits of people she'd never met. And it was such a high creepiness factor, where you had these things that was like a death mask on the wall with a Petri dish with a cigarette butt or a piece of chewing gum and like a date, like Penn Station, 1:03 a.m. and whatever. And it became the biggest news story that GenSpace was ever in terms of number of publications that carried it. And she went on to do this wonderful other piece called Invisible, where she had the spray that you could spray, you know, the glass that you could use and erase your DNA so no one could get it. And it was all about genomic privacy, and it was very relevant because the Supreme Court had just decided that it was legal for an arresting officer to take a DNA sample and keep it on record. And by the way, there are some things that are being undone right now by President Trump that will allow insurance companies, companies, corporations, to insist that you get your DNA tested. And if you don't, it's supposedly voluntary, but you have to pay a fine, which can be thousands of dollars, apparently. So genomic privacy highlighted by this particular project was really great. On the other hand, I've just stepped down as the director, and the new director is a science journalist, but he has, for the past few years, been running something called the Biodesign Challenge, which is pairing up scientists with design professors, running a semester-long course where the students imagine the future of biotech. And the problem is, it gets pretty wild. And this is what gets picked up and reported by news services. And if you don't have the background knowledge to vet some of this stuff, you'll see a lot of this artistic interpretation. It's like science fiction films about genetic engineers are universally dystopic. You know, we're always the bad guy that does Jurassic Park or something. And that's the perception that the public can get sometimes through some of these artistic projects, is this distorted view of the science. So it's kind of a very fine line. It can certainly raise awareness, but sometimes it creates some sort of indelible impression that you can't get rid of. And by the way, one of the things that he did was he put a picture that was very pretty of a hand holding a Petri dish on our front page. It just happens to be a pathogen on blood agar. And he has no clue. So that's the only sort of caveat I have about that sort of thing.
We have an artist in residence at JPL. He's a full-time artist at JPL, and the most popular outreach product NASA has ever produced is his series of travel posters about different exoplanets. So all the we now know of nearly 5,000 planets around other stars, and he produced travel posters for some of them. And it was an interesting argument because we know next to nothing about these planets. I mean, we have an estimate of their sizes, and in some cases their densities, but that's really it. But he was having, you know, wonderful depictions of what these planets might be like, and so there was some controversy with that too. But that was a very successful outreach product. So
you decided to go ahead with it, even though it wasn't particularly accurate.
Right. I mean, it was accurate as we could do, plus a good dose of imagination thrown in, mm-hmm. and they've been downloaded and reproduced millions of times. So, all right, student question. And we're wrapping up now. Probably one more question. If we have time for another one, we'll go, but we're down to 5 minutes. So the student question says, do you think that changing the ways in which we distribute information online can address the lack of science literacy in the general public? Distributing information online, how could that maybe get at this problem? Maybe have a comment on that?
Well, I'm not any kind of expert on this stuff. I just feel like there's so much information overload, and then we were talking about we can't really, people don't even have abilities now to like what's a reliable source versus a non-reliable source. And I think that it's just my impression that it's kind of had this whole impact, just the information overload in general to people. It's like, you know, if you've ever watched any of those shows for the Tonight Show people, they go out on the street and they ask people, who's this a picture of? And it's Joe Biden. And it's like nobody on the street knows, these 20-year-old kids don't know who their vice president is and stuff. And I think that there just seems to be this lack of, I don't know, it's like there's just so much information and so people kind of tune out of it. So in theory, it definitely seems like you should be able to put these things online and they're going to increase science literacy. But I think that just so much information, and then there's all the crazy stuff, and then you get tired because it's like, well, what's real and what's crazy, and you know, what's somebody with an agenda that's trying to, and it seems like that there's, for all of us, but certainly in generations coming up, it's like, you know, they don't really, I think it's a great idea, I just don't know that it would work, but I think that's because there's been some other cultural shifts, and I mean, certainly when I was 20, I know who the vice president was, and certainly, you know, it's like that kind of stuff. It's like, it's not just science literacy. I just think in general, people are just like, ooh, and maybe it's because there's just so much information out there.
I have to share my favorite. They asked someone, name 4 Renaissance painters. Name 4 Ninja Turtles. Oh, Raphael,
right.
Donatello.
I think there's an answer to that. I think it's too late to change the internet, but I think if you're a person who's responsible for helping people find out where to get good information, you can tell them where to get the good information. NASA is a reliable source for for astrophysics, planetary science, and all the rest of it. The National Academies of Science is a good source for biomedical information. Even Wikipedia, when it first started, was not all that reliable. Now it's gotten better and better and better. So I tell students, internet is fine, check your sources, and here are some sources where you can start. That's not so hard to do, and it puts at least a little bit of structure on the mass of stuff out there in the internet.
Well, and you're putting it in context for them in the context of your class, but if you're just talking about somebody surfing
sure,
the web,
in general,
because
right.
they might have read 10 websites before talking about how crazy wackadoo NASA is trying to
right.
convince you that there's planets outside
That's
this galaxy,
true.
You know, and so if they don't have any
right.
context for that, like what's reliable or not, it makes it difficult. Just like
you're right.
That's the...
Well, on that note, we're out of time. I apologize if I didn't get to your questions. We got a lot of them, so thank you very much.